Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast. I'm Chaz Hathaway. Today we're going to share from the experience of one Spencer as it recorded in the book Visions of Glory by John Pontius. And this is deep into his experience, but there's a lot to his experience, so we're not going to read the whole experience. That would take an entire book. And so we're going to go ahead and read a little sample here. Instantly, we were in another place. I recognized it immediately, and I should say this is well into the experience. He's been going around and experiencing some landscapes and so forth with his guide, and so, you know, it's not like he's just barely dying right now, but we're further on into the experience at this moment. Instantly, we were in another place. I recognized it immediately. It was my home where I had spent all of my spiritual childhood. The building before me was immense, stretching to my right and left as far as I could see. It consisted of many beautiful parts. There were majestic arches, tall walls, windows of every shape, stunning architecture, and glorious ornamentation. The structure was made of a stone-like material, white in color, but more like pearl, with gold and silver streaks that seemed to be moving slowly around larger emerald veins, as if they had occurred in natural stone. Each block of stone was about as tall as a man. A long-ago memory arose in my mind of watching Father create it. I had come to its present form over a long period. It had come to its present form over a long period of time, though time was just a limited way my mind understood it. It was just a continuation of the eternal now in my memory. The building had taken shape with purpose. God wanted a room to teach me in, so the building had obeyed his desire. He loved columns and representations of the beauty of his earthly creations near the tops of the columns along the ceiling and over the doors, and it had all obeyed. I realized that some rooms had been created to teach me my first lessons of things I would encounter on earth. Others had been shaped to allow me to see and touch objects to teach me, such as books, art, tools, and many other things I needed to prepare me for earth life. It was less of a building than a divine place that had assumed the shape of an earthly building for my education. It could take any shape God conceived. It did not require work, workmanship, tools, or trades to change it. It simply flowed in joyful obedience into any shape he wished. My guide opened a large door that was made from a single piece of wood. There were no joints or seams, as if God had asked a single tree to assume the shape of this elaborate door. The wood was unpainted and beautifully carved with natural wonders from earth, flowers, animals, children, men, and women in loving moments. The room beyond was a familiar entryway. The whole of what I saw radiated a sense of vibrant excitement that I was back. The walls and columns were of the same divine stone as outside. The ceiling was vaulted, resting upon four fluted columns with light radiating from everything. The floor was darker, more like a natural marble of dark emerald green. There was a closed door to my right, a wide hallway directly before me, and another closed door to my left. My guide led me to the corridor before us. It was about 20 feet long and ended in an arched window that looked like pearl. It appeared to be fluid, with smoky white columns shifting in it. As we approached it, it turned clear so that I could see through it. The large room beyond was again familiar to me. He looked at me and asked, "Do you know this place?" I said, with tears of joy streaming down my face, I'm back home. In my mind, I thought, this is where I used to live before I was born. I knew I was back in the spirit world where I grew up as a spirit child. Many sacred memories and scenes flowed through my mind of spiritual childhood, which I choose not to relate here. I stood there for a long while, never entering but watching and remembering my past. When I was satisfied again, and again ready to move on, my guide took me back to the entry and to the first door I had seen. The door opened for me as I approached. I recognized it as my room, almost like a bedroom for a mortal child, but there was no bed here. The room was 20 square feet with a high, flat ceiling. The walls and floor were of the same material as the foyer, but with slightly different colors, lending more toward blue and mauve. I loved this room, and I felt as if it was all mine. The only furniture in the room was a large rounded top chest sitting in the middle of the floor. It was about 3 feet by 4 feet with an arched lid and rounded corners. The top was a beautiful red with highlights of burnt orange. It was made of the same material as the rest of the home, but it was thinner and brightly colored. The sides of the chest were a vivid canary yellow. I knew that I had picked these colors and changed them often to suit my childhood whims. The lid could be opened, but there were no visible hinges. I stepped to it, and after walking around it, I glanced at my guide questioningly. He smiled, and I slowly raised the lid. The substance gave my mortal memory the message that it was heavy, but it felt feather-like as I opened it. Within were strange objects I had never seen in mortality. There were utensils of strange shapes and different sizes, white clothing and tools that I had used. I knew exactly what each tool and object was for as I stood there in the spirit, but since returning to mortality, that information has not remained with me. I realized that I owned them, but also that such things were common to our premortal experience. Still, their connection to me had been part of my early experiences. I picked up each one, looked at it, and remembered what it was for. Each object in the chest was an achievement of mine. Each object represented an accomplishment, like a trophy of sorts, of a lesson learned, ordinations I had received, stages of development that I had achieved. These objects signified my worthiness and preparation to participate in the object of the lesson, not just in this world, but in the mortal world as well. These things were like certificates, authorizing me to actually do those things. Each ability and authority was gained by a long process of qualifying for and earning that authority. I had received these objects as tokens of lessons I had learned and qualifications I had achieved. Some of the objects were actual tools to assist me in that act. To my memory of these things, they seemed to me to be divine technology, objects endowed with power by God to allow and assist me in doing some necessary service or act, like the Liahona that assisted Lehi's family, or the Urim and Thummim that enabled seers to see the future. The white clothing was carefully folded and was sacred and ceremonial in nature. It was all part of my matriculation to spiritual maturity. As I picked them up, the lessons learned, the process of learning, and the joy I felt in the achievement returned to me. I treasured each object with all my heart and pondered on them and then placed them carefully back in the chest. Nothing in the chest was a toy or a whimsical object. Everything had deep, eternal meaning to me. Each object recognized me and was happy to see and interact with me. I felt no reason to hurry. My guide was watching me, smiling and enjoying my discoveries. It was as if I had an eternity to examine them. After handling them and understanding them, I remembered the nature of the room. I realized that I had possessed the ability to change the room into anything I needed. If I desired to read a book that belonged to mortality, like scripture or a scroll written by a mortal prophet, I simply desired it, and the room would change to provide that thing to me. It came in the setting it had been used, in a palace, a cave, or on a desk. This is how it appeared to me. I could touch it, pick it up, and read it. I could feel and even smell it. It was not the actual object summoned from some eternal storage vault, but a flawless spiritual recreation or representation of it. Each object was perfectly like the original, including all of the memories and history a spirit individual could experience from the original object. If I wanted to see something large, such as the birth of Christ or the creation of the earth, that event would surround me. I could watch it and learn from it, interact with it, see the angels and divine beings who had enacted the original events. I could move around it and see it from every angle with perfect clarity and experienced everything and everyone involved in the initial event. In short, it was magnificent, and it was the most perfect classroom in eternity, and all who desired it had one just like mine. Okay, I'm going to stop there because, I mean, this just goes on and on with fascinating stuff. And again, we've read from this in the past, that we took 3 podcasts, in fact, reading from this book because of all the fascinating stuff that we found in here. But I'm finding this to be an incredible source of perspective around some of the things that we hear about near-death experiences. You know, well, let's just kind of comb through this again a little bit. So the house that he grew up in. Now, I haven't read back or forward to know that as a spirit child, was he a little spirit person? You know, was he a little, did he look like a 4-year-old as a spirit? Or, you know, was this an adult size that was just considered a child because he hadn't been to Earth yet? I don't know. I would imagine that at some point he looked like a child and looked like a baby at some point. I don't know. But clearly this home had been what he considered his spiritual childhood, where he had spent his spiritual childhood. And he even says, this is where I used to live before I was born. He says, I'm back home. And it's interesting the little things that are said about it. For example, that God had built it for him using what? A command, it sounds like. He says it didn't require work, workmanship, tools, or trades to change it. It simply flowed in joyful obedience into any shape that he, God, wished. And God created this room for him specifically. And I imagine, based on other things that I've read, that he had a spiritual family that he grew up with, a spirit group, if you will, that was a family that helped and guided him in these lessons and so forth. But at the same time, too, it sounds like he was very familiar with Father, just as a person on this earth would be familiar with their own mortal father. And so there's certainly that. But also, and again, to many who hear these kinds of things, they're like, but wait a minute, how could God, the eternal Father of us all, have time to spend, you know, this eternity or whatever with each individual? And to that answer, we have to bring up again that concept of, we're talking about spiritual things. When you get into the things of the spirit, time is not a factor. Now, why? I don't know. I mean, when time doesn't exist, or at least not in the way it does here, time is not a factor. If there's something that should have taken eons to take place, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because time is not an issue. So how could God have raised each of us as individuals with a father and a mother and, you know, in this setting of a home and a bedroom and so forth, without a bed, obviously, from what he says, but, you know, how could he have raised each of us that way? But the only thing that really stands in the way of that is time. And time is not a factor in the things of the Spirit. The eternal now, as keeps coming up, allows for time to not be an issue. And so, it's not a problem. It's not a problem. Okay, continuing on. It's interesting how he says that the wood is, you know, the door was made of a single piece of wood, no joints or seams, as if God had asked a single tree to assume the shape of this elaborate door. And to the question of, well, wouldn't it have to be rooted? Well, what for? What kind of nourishment does a tree need of roots and so forth? And that's not to say that this was clearly a tree, but because the guy says, as if a tree had been, you know, told to, or invited to take on this shape. You know, I don't know what that means. Is the wood a life form of itself? Well, from what I understand, it's some kind of life form, even if it's not part of a living tree in its tree form. You know, there's something of creation about, you know, a desk that it glories in both its creator and in the glory that it is for God in bringing people, helping people through their experiences and coming to God and so forth. You know, I am desk glorifying you, glorifying God, or serving you, serving God, I think is the wording that has been used in the past. I am a couch serving you, serving God, and so forth. There seems to be that kind of attitude about everything, both in the spirit world and to some level in the mortal world as well. But anyway, very interesting. And then it's kind of cool that he remembers this door, and in this door there's this elaborate shapes, unpainted and beautifully carved with natural wonders from earth. Flowers, animals, children, men and women in loving moments. So everything's kind of reflecting this teaching in preparation for earth life. What were the lessons that we received prior to coming to earth? Now, whether there were eons before these lessons regarding how to live as a spirit, I don't know. But it seems very clear to me from this that there was a long period of growing up as a spiritual child in preparation for our earth life. Now, that seems bizarre to us when we think about eternity. And you know, if you're a Star Trek fan, you think of the Q continuum and how they're in this just infinite loop of just existing and existing and everything. Everybody's done everything. Everybody's seen everything. So everybody's bored out of their skulls. And so people just stop doing things, you know. That's a mortal way of looking at eternity. That is not at all the way a spirit sees eternity. A spirit seems to see eternity as this ongoing growth and progression process, this ongoing lesson and experiences and joys and relationships, all continually growing and learning and growing and learning. And this house that had existed for eons, apparently, that were created by God for Spencer and probably his family, whatever, was all built so as to teach about the mortal world and to prepare for earth life. And if this took place for eons, if these lessons and so on took place for eons, for Spencer to be able to come to this earth for this brief period of time, experience mortality, and then return, then how important is this life really? If ever you're in the study of near-death experiences, tempted to think, I just want to go home. I just want to go home because it's so much more beautiful, so much more perfect there. Stop and think about this. We valued this mortal experience so much that we spent eons of time preparing for it. As spirit children, as growing and progressing spirits, preparing for this mortal time. And now, you know, how much of what we experience in the spirit was in preparation for the mortal experience, and how much of mortal experience is a reflection of that spirit world, I don't know for sure. I would suggest or suspect that they're one and the same. You know, when you see something from the spirit world that finds its way on in Earth, and then you find something on Earth that we have a replica of in the spirit world in order to prepare or remind us of the Earth, you know, why would you have both? Well, it's kind of like asking the question, why do you have this wild, beautiful, foresty-like garden that reminds you of your favorite camping spot, you know, when you may take seeds from your garden to see if you can get them to grow in your favorite camping spot, and then in your favorite camping spot has things that you want to emulate in your home garden. You know, is that inconsistent? It's like, which came from which? And the answer is, this is you we're talking about. You love the plants and the arrangements that are in both, and so you try to reflect them in both. And I think that seems to be what's kind of happening here. And yet, if you are from one and you are, well, let's just put it this way. Spencer says that there are many things in this house that are to prepare him for this earth. And of course, as he's going back now, they are beautiful to see, and the memory of them brings him great joy. I hope that's making sense. I may have gone off on a ridiculous tangent, but I think there's something to that. If you ask, well, why would they have cars in the spirit world if you can travel? Well, because we like cars. And perhaps to prepare the way for, you know, mortality, and both, you know, all of the above. And maybe cars were invented because there was such a thing in the spirit world that reflected, you know, transportation that we thought, well, let's make it here too, you know. And somebody was inspired to build it. So I think there's some of both, you know. I don't see any reason it can't be both. Now, this is interesting what he says about his bedroom and how there's this chest. Okay, it's kind of fun that he says it doesn't have hinges. It just knows what to do. So very much reflecting the life aspect of all, everything on that side. That it didn't need hinges because it knew the intent of how you would open, and then it could just stay in that position. I think that's kind of interesting. I'm not sure you would find in every spirit anything, well, there's like no hinges in the spirit world. That's probably not the case, but there's probably the case that sometimes they don't have hinges because they don't need them. They just know what they're supposed to do, you know, the items themselves. Kind of interesting. And he does just say, but there were no visible hinges. Maybe there were some that he couldn't see or that weren't obvious. I don't know. But so he lifts the lid of this chest, kind of in, you know, remember that as he's experiencing this, memories are flooding in. So things are reminding him of experiences from his time previous to this earth. So he opens it up in curiosity, not sure what's in there, not remembering what's in there. And as he opens it up, he says, he smiled, I stepped to it, and after walking around it, I glanced at my guide questioningly. He smiled, and I slowly raised the lid. The substance gave my mortal memory a message that it was heavy, but it felt feather light as I opened it. Okay, so he opens it up. Within were strange objects I had never seen in mortality. They were utensils of strange shapes and different sizes, white clothing, and tools that I had used. So these are things that he hadn't needed in mortality. These are not like a hammer and saw or tools that we would use in the mortal world, but these are things that were tools in the spirit world and things that you wouldn't have here. And he says that the memory of how and what they were used for has mostly been taken from him. Some memories he chooses to withhold from the public eye, probably because they were very private for his individual experiences and maybe some of his own individual earth experiences with family or friends or whatever that he's keeping private. But it sounds like most of them he doesn't remember the use that they had. But he does say that each object represented an accomplishment, like a trophy of sorts, of a lesson learned or ordinations he had received, stages of development that he had achieved. And they were kind of like a representation of the thing that he had learned, the worthiness that he had developed, the what we might equate to a skill or development. You know, when you have a trophy from your high school basketball time, and let's say, let's even put it this way, let's say it's a basketball signed by your teammates, okay? That basketball has use. You could still play basketball with it, but it's a symbol of your experience being on the basketball team. And the accomplishments, the lessons that you learned from your coach, from the games, from the losses, from the victories, it sounds like it's similar kinds of things to that. That each of these trinkets, and yet he says they're not trinkets, they're not playthings, they are representations of achievements and their tools, utensils, as he puts them, puts it. He says each ability and authority that was gained by these things, he says, these things were like certificates authorizing me to actually do those things. So it's like being handed that basketball at the end, signed by each of the players. It was a way of saying, okay, now you can truly play basketball. And here you go. Now you have the authority, the responsibility, the whatever, to do it. And so this is interesting to me, so interesting. It says, each ability and authority was gained by a long process of qualifying for and earning that authority. I had received these objects as tokens of lessons I had learned and qualifications I had achieved. And it's think of it like a carpenter, you know, an apprenticeship to a carpenter working with this hammer, and you've got this really good, nice hammer that really fulfills its purpose very well, and it's like the perfect hammer. And in the lessons and in the learning of how to use it, you achieve this level of carpentry that says you are now qualified. You have taken the tests, you have passed the exams, you have, you know, inspections, whatever, so that you can now be an authorized legal carpenter, and here is your hammer that you can use for that. It's as if these objects are being representations of that authority, as well as being useful objects, as well as being tokens of the lessons learned, etc. And all the lessons seem to be within the objects to remind him of that authority, the lessons, everything. Interesting. He says, some of the objects were actual tools to assist me in the act. To my memory of these things, they seemed to me to be divine technology, objects endowed with power by God to allow and assist me in doing some necessary service or act. Very interesting, very interesting. And then he talks about If you remember, or if you know your biblical history and the Urim and Thummim that the priests used to enable them in the gift of being a seer or to see the future and so forth. I mean, these are tools that would allow him to do things that he was given spiritual gifts to do. He says it was all part of my matriculation to spiritual maturity. And for non-American friends, or I mean for all you American friends who don't use the word matriculation, often that's kind of the equivalent of graduation to spiritual maturity. So that's so interesting. Both the idea of there being tools for spiritual authority, use, whatever, technology, divine technology, and this idea of lessons learned and preparing for life on Earth. I'm left to wonder a little bit more, what would our premortal lessons entail? Because this gives such a vivid picture of experiences, he's in this spirit home that he grew up in as a spirit to prepare him for mortality. Sounds like his whole spiritual, pre-mortal experience from the time of this house being built or manifest, or however you want to word that, to the time of his coming to Earth was to prepare him to come to Earth, because things were so important that he would experience on Earth. And also his spiritual growth, receiving authority, receiving qualifications and so forth for the experiences that he would need to have in the spirit as well as in the body. You know, it's very interesting. Going on, I love this, what he says, when he says, he says, my guide was watching me, smiling and enjoying my discoveries. It was as if I had an eternity to examine them. So all these different discoveries, these objects and so forth, doors and whatever. After handling them and understanding them, I remembered the nature of the room. I realized that it had possessed the ability to change the room into anything I needed. If you're a Harry Potter fan, this is almost like the room of requirement. I mean, whatever he needed it to be, he said, if I desired to read a book that belonged to mortality, like a scripture or a scroll written by a mortal prophet, I simply desired it and the room would change to provide that thing to me. It came in the setting it had been used, in a palace, a cave, or on a desk. So if he needed to read, Fall of the Roman Empire or whatever, he might find the room looking like a Roman, cathedral or something, whatever they had in Roman times. And if needing to understand, something about animals or something, he might find himself in a cave or forest-like setting or something, is what I'm picturing around this book that would manifest itself as a way of learning. And he says it came in a setting that had been used, desk, whatever. This is how it appeared to me. I could touch it. He's talking about the book or any aspect of the room, whatever. I could touch it, pick it up, and read it. I could feel it and even smell it. It was not the actual object summoned from the eternal storage vault, from some eternal storage vault, but a flawless spiritual recreation or representation of it. Each object was perfectly like the original, including all of the memories and history a spirit individual could experience from the original object. This is wild! Oh my gosh! Okay, so say there was a book, from the Library of Alexandria. Let's just play with that because, all the curious items from the past. With all of its history behind it, in this room, his own room, just his own personal room, nothing special except that every room is special, okay? It kind of, nobody has superpowers because all of them have, everybody has them. So there's nothing special about this room except that everybody has this special kind of room of their own. And this is his space to learn and to grow. And he can summon this book from the Library of Alexandria, learn the entire history of the people, not just what's written in the book, but the entire history of everyone who had ever touched it, who had ever experienced it, and is able to absorb the knowledge and understanding from that book as if it's the original, and yet it is a perfect recreation of the original with all its history, with all of its whatever. Bah! That's crazy and awesome. And that means, too, if I'm understanding this right, that every individual, you know, the kid next door, which, you know, could be light years away, or he could be just, you know, in the next room or whatever, is also holding that same book, which is a perfect replica of the original of that book from Alexandria or whatever, you know, and we're talking about books so far, but it sounds like it could be any object. It could be a, you know, artifact from, you know, an Egyptian tomb. It could be a stone or a whatever, and it possesses all the powers, all the history, and all the memories of the original. Duh, that's crazy. That just the learning. I mean, what you could learn in such a place. He says, if I wanted to see something large, such as the birth of Christ or the creation of the earth, that event would surround me. I could watch it and learn from it, interact with it, see the angels and divine beings who had enacted the original events. I could move around it and see it from every angle with perfect clarity and experience everything and everyone involved in the initial event. In short, it was magnificent, and it was the most perfect classroom in eternity. And all who desired it had one just like me. If that doesn't blow your mind, I don't know what will, because that completely blows my mind. I mean, no need to hoard, no need to have a full room packed with stuff, because, I mean, if you want it, it appears, it's there. And if you open this chest and reach in and pull one of those objects out, it's there, you know? That's wild. That's wild. I don't understand it, but it's fascinating to me. I'm going to have to think about that some more. And yet, it illustrates how valuable this life is. Because if in the spirit form, learning comes so effortlessly, if it becomes so, I mean, just at the asking, you can have a book there to read with all its history and all its context and get to know the individuals and meet any person who ever existed in the history of the world or beyond. And so much of our time spent there is in preparation for this earth life. Then what is it that we are supposed to learn while we are here? Is it facts? Is it, you know, the exact political structure of the Roman Empire at the time of its falling? Well, that's all helpful and useful because it, you know, all these things that we're learning are, you know, we're learning in the spirit world were to prepare us for coming here, and so relearning it here is certainly valuable, certainly. But what is it exactly that we are to learn while we are here? I can only speculate, but let me give you a few possibilities. One is love, okay? Because while love was perfect there, and it's kind of like you're surrounded completely by it, it's hard to learn it in that setting because you're not separated from it. On earth, every one of us, every one of you listening, can probably relate to some time that in some way you didn't feel loved. it sounds like prior to coming to this earth, you never experienced that. You had no sense of loneliness, no sense of loss, no sense of recognizing what it really feels like to be rejected, to be hurt, to be truly, deeply, and utterly offended. And yet here we have that experience. Not that we are here to experience as much loss and pain and loneliness as possible, but rather to experience that enough so that we can know how to love within that context. Because if you, as an individual who are lost and lonely and afraid, can extend love in that context, then that's where you learn love. That's where you learn the power of compassion, the power of forgiveness, the power of reaching out and helping those around us. And also the power of love in a world that is so packed with judgments. Remember, over there you don't feel judgment. You don't feel it. So here, where judgment is so heavy and so pressing, to be able to love and accept within that context, and to learn to not judge or hate or judge those who are doing the judging. This is a big one to me, really, really big to me, because I see when we get into, oh, there's no judgment, often we end up slipping to just the other side of that same judgment coin by saying, we shouldn't be judging. You've got to stop judging. You're being so judgmental. You got to stop being that way. You got to stop. You see where I'm going with that? We're judging those who judge. And what this context of mortality seems to provide is a situation where we can be under this pressing challenge of judgment, of pain, of suffering, of loneliness, of fear, all these things that are unique to mortality, and still learn to forgive, learn to show compassion, learn to let go of the judgment that hurts people, and allow only the judgment of things like, this person looks like they could use a loving arm. Around, or a hand around their shoulder, arm around their shoulder. This looks like someone that I could help. That is a judgment call, yes, but it is the kind of judgment that teaches and learns and fulfills love and compassion and forgiveness. Those lessons were difficult to learn in the spirit world because we were surrounded so entirely by them. By the what was already there. How does one learn to swim if one breathes underwater and doesn't have the need to stay above water? You know what I'm saying? How does one learn to stay above fear and to act in love above fear where there is no fear? I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting to me. What other things to learn? Humility. What need have we for the learning of humility when we're in a place where we are as perfect and great as every other person around us? You know, we can all be as prideful or as humble as we want up there, and it doesn't matter. Nobody's thinking about that kind of thing. And so, how does one learn humility? Remember the experience... I can't remember how long ago it was we shared it, where this woman, she had actually committed suicide, and she was in this place where she realized, oh, these are the suicides. And yet, others hadn't necessarily killed themselves, taken their own life, but rather they had lived their lives in complete selfishness, or they had lived lives of utter, you know, they had, you know, crawled so deeply within themselves that they couldn't see the people around them, so to speak. They were completely devoid of compassion or maybe empathy because they had ingrained it in themselves so heavily in the earth, in their earth life, in their mortal form, that they were struggling as spirits to overcome that. And there was a man there who was kind of a master of humility that had been sent to be their guide and their help. And he was there to offer the lesson of humility that they were having such a hard time learning in the spirit form. And why were they having such a hard time learning it in the spirit form? Simply because it's so much easier to learn here on this planet, in this mortal life, when our bodies are so confining and they're so pain inducing and they're so, they have such a hard time because of fear and because of anxiety and because of depression and physical and mental disabilities and all these things that we suffer with, and all the mental instabilities that we experience, the emotional instabilities, in that context where everything is so pressing, we're in a place where we can learn humility in its truest, deepest form easily compared to the spirit. Humility, love, compassion. These are the lessons that I think we really came here to learn. And if you can draw close to God in a situation where you don't see Him, you don't feel Him, you don't hear His voice, you can't touch Him and hug Him, whereas in the spirit world you could do that anytime without any trouble, how do you draw close to a being when you can have them at your disposal, quote unquote, at any time? It's challenging. That sounds counterintuitive until you think about what we came to this life to learn. If we experienced an eternity of having infinite capacity for learning, infinite capacity for meeting anyone, then what did we come here to learn? It seems to me that we can learn to come closer to God here than we could there, in some way, at least, because we are not in His presence. We have to act in faith. We have to act in hope that He is there, because we don't see Him. We don't feel Him. All of you who are listening who are not near-death experiencers, I speak to you for a moment, because we've spoken so much about those who have seen Him, who have touched Him, who have felt Him, who have heard Him, who have spoken with Him. And yet you maybe have not, at least not to the extent that those who have had the experiences have. You are in the perfect setting to come to know Him more deeply and more intimately than you could do in the spirit. And why? Because He is not with you. Because you don't feel Him. You know that whole, distance makes the heart grow stronger, or grow fonder, sorry. There is the capacity for that on a level, on a spiritual level that goes way beyond just being apart from someone you actually physically remember. Seek God while you are here, and when you meet Him there, your knowledge of Him will be deeper, will be fonder, will be more intense, more infinite and intimate than it ever could have been previously. Your experience with Him will be more deep and more meaningful because you experienced Him in a place where you could not experience Him. I don't know if that seems to make sense, but let's face it, this life in so many ways doesn't make sense. And if we're leaving a place, preparing for eons to leave, to come to a place where we would be separated from all of it because of the learning, spiritual learning that we would do here, then what are we here to learn? And I think all those things that I was just talking about, I think that's part of it. Anyway, if you would like to contact the podcast, you can do so by emailing neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com or by calling 970-NDE-CAST. And once again, thank you all of you so much for listening.